Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our program. We've got a great show coming up for you with part two of an episode we started last week on rural EMS challenges, especially with regard to disasters and large-scale hazard responses. We'll be continuing on with that discussion featuring Chris Prutzman from Samaritan EMS in Oklahoma, as well as, of course, Dr. Joe Holly, myself, Kyle Nelson, and my co-host, Sam Bradley, all really carrying on the discussion as we get into some clinical topics in this week's episode. So without further ado, let's go ahead and pick up with part two of this episode on rural EMS topics.
Well, let's switch gears a little bit. I want to throw in a few clinical ideas here, too, because it's a very different environment. Chris, you mentioned something about on-the-job injuries for EMS providers, and there's an increased risk for that. You want to expand on that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the urban EMS provider has sidewalks and parking lots and lots of hands around with first response agencies to help lift and carry and move equipment and, you know, patients and things of that nature. You know, the rural EMS providers, depending on how active their fire departments are, may be, you know, two providers on a unit going into a very rural residence that doesn't have paved driveways or paved sidewalks. So they're moving equipment and people across uneven terrain in and out of homes that were probably built some time ago. So there's a increased risk of, you know, uneven surfaces and steps and things of that nature. And it just is a much greater risk of, you know, injury to your personnel. You know, prime example, working a cardiac arrest with an ambulance crew, having to move that patient, ventilate, continue compressions, you know, try to provide the ALS care in a very protocol-driven, timely manner becomes a huge task. And, we're also seeing a rise, you know, in employee injuries. Thankfully, not in my agency, but just across the state with, you know, with these environments. So I think that's another, obviously, danger to the profession, a danger to the rural provider. And there's obviously a cost associated with that to take care of the folks that do get hurt on the job. Again, another, you know, kind of hurdle for the rural provider to try to maintain that level of service while combating, you know, that particular side of it.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. You see the same challenges, Jamie?
Oh, yeah. I mean, injuries and things like that are taxing to every system, not just the paid systems, but the volunteer systems as well, and certainly the paid rural systems as well. And the challenge that you face is, when you have, you know, 1,000 employees and you lose one to a serious back injury for an extended period of time, it's taxing to the system, but you can cover it. It's quite another thing when you've got a service that has a total of 15 employees and you lose somebody. Then you're dealing with a lot of overtime to cover that shift, and that can be a make or break situation when you're dealing with tight budgets. And I'm sure Chris can flesh that out a little bit more.
Jamie, I'll also add to that. In these rural situations, they're much less likely to be able to afford the additional tools that might help reduce those injuries, things like power lift stretchers and equipment like that. That it is quite expensive and seems to help to reduce injuries, but in those situations are less likely to be available.
Yeah, really good point. I'm sure you see some of those kinds of injuries in the ER too. Hopefully, not too many.
Absolutely.
If you see them in the ER, then it's got to be pretty bad, rather than their occupational health provider. Kyle, you had another thought you wanted to throw out.
Yeah, Sam. I know up to this point we've been talking a lot about the challenges and some of the things that may not go so well for us in the rural EMS setting. But one thing I do want to say from my experience, both on the first responder side as well as the dispatch side of things, is I'm truly amazed here in central Colorado, how many folks and on the public safety side are cross-trained between different skill sets? So you may have, we have law enforcement officers who are also firefighters, who are also EMTs or paramedics, and who also do ski patrol. And so there's a lot of kind of interweaving of these different professions. And one thing that really amazes me is when, you know, even if you're sending, if we have an officer arrive first on a medical call, they've been working with our fire and EMS agencies to be trained on how to give good patient reports on the fire channel so that as soon as they arrive on scene, they can do a quick assessment. If we can go from a lights and siren response to a non-code response, so no lights and siren, that can take that stress and that risk away from those EMS folks, you know, very, very quickly. So it's something that we do is we cross train. And so our law enforcement and fire folks, when they arrive, they can give those good updates and be able to also provide those critical interventions before an EMS unit may arrive on scene.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Dr. Joe, we know you have to go attend to some things. So do you have any final thoughts on what we talked about so far?
Well, I think it's been a great conversation overall. You know, it just shows you the additional challenges that rural settings cause based on, you know, smaller numbers of people, smaller numbers of trained people, less depth and resources. And so when, you know, disasters hit those areas, although there's fewer people affected, it's significantly more challenging to respond in those arenas because of all those limitations.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Well, Joe, we'll let you run and take care of your business, and we'll look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks, guys. I look forward to talking to you all soon. Have a great one.
So, Chris, Jamie had asked you a question about something, and we got a little bit off to the side. Jamie, you remember what that question was you wanted him to clarify?
I think I was just talking about the challenges of losing somebody, you know, a single crew member is a lot different and a lot more impactful to a small rural service than it is to a larger metropolitan service. And I'm sure he's seen that in his situation as well.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, just this last week, we had a kind of what I was alluding to earlier. We had a crew that responded to a rural resident for a cardiac arrest. This patient was a rather large patient. We don't have any fire response in that area per se from an emergency responder situation. So my crew worked the resuscitation and moved this very large patient out of the house, transported to the hospital, and after running the call, both of them were actually injured on that call. So I now have an entire crew that's out of service that's 60 miles away from my next closest base with two ambulance providers in between my base and that base. And I, as Dr. Joe had mentioned, you know, that base is staffed by basically seven people. So I've just taken two of those folks out of the equation, obviously, to get treatment. And then how do I staff to cover that in the upcoming shifts? How long are they going to be off? You know, those are challenges that not only I face, but a lot of rural providers face every day. And with the extended injuries, as we were talking about, you know, not only does that obviously affect my service, but that affects that provider's family and the overall livelihood, because we know that disability does not compensate at the same level that my normal wages would. So it's a very, very challenging situation for me as a provider and an employer, and it's a very challenging situation for them. But I also would say that, you know, most of the folks that do work the rurals are very committed to those communities. That's why they work there. And, you know, that's a reason to do the job. And I think that when these situations arise, especially with injury and things of that nature, that also kind of takes a toll on them because they feel like they're not there to serve that community. So it's a very rough situation, and I thank my lucky stars every day that I don't have to encounter that a lot, but every once in a while we do. And
you know, it's a very challenging time to get all that stuff covered.
Wow. What do you think, Jamie?
Well, I think, you know, it backs up what I just said. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm wondering is if as we run into this more and more frequently, as injury management becomes a hotter topic with crew resource management, I wonder if we're going to see changes to medical protocols with an eye towards whether we how we manage patients like the one that Chris mentioned. If you have a two-person crew and it's not a safe lift, do you lift anyway? You know, for some patients, you know, is a cardiac arrest maybe the protocols for those things need to be managed in different ways and start talking about viable and non-viable patients to protect the crews from injuries in a situation where it was not necessary. And that's a hard thing to, that's a hard discussion to have. And I see that's something that's going to be brought up time and again as more and more research goes into managing cardiac arrests effectively.
That could be a whole podcast, Jamie. That certainly Joe would have some opinions on, because that's what he's doing a lot of research with. But you're absolutely right. I mean, just the response times alone, you know, 3 to 4 minutes. So, yeah, that's a really good point. What do you think about that, Chris?
Oh, I think that's an excellent discussion to open up and have. One of the things that I have been saying for quite a long time, you know, our industry is judged on cardiac arrest management and basically, you know, the golden hour and the 10-minute seam time for the trauma patients. And in my experience, you know, not that I don't want to sound as if I don't value the practice of cardiac arrest management, but you know, I think some of this is very flawed in the fact that we don't take into account all of those arrest patients. We talk about witness V5, VTAC, cardiac arrest versus asystolic, and what are really the survival rates of those patients. And to the point that we're discussing, you know, this particular patient remained asystolic the entire arrest. You know, is this something that we want to risk a crew and an ambulance and you know, everything that services that with that one community with the one ambulance driving emergently on a patient that we're more than likely not going to get ROSC on. I think it's a very interesting discussion. I think that it would be a very spirited discussion, but I think that to manage the rural communities appropriately, I think we need to design new systems a little bit differently. Be able to provide what's appropriate for not only the patient but the providers as well.
That's true, and I think if you have a lot of very firm protocols, so nobody can turn around and say, "Well, they just didn't want to take care of my relative." Well, no, they don't understand all these other factors that go into it. So,
that comes back again to educating your public to what to expect. That so when you go and do that community CPR education, you talk to them about the amount of time it takes to get there. You talk to them about you can't save every patient. You talk to them about the real numbers of cardiac arrest survival and that only certain types of cardiac arrest are survivable. So that when you come to the house, they've learned something about what to expect. And they're hopeful, but not having unrealistic expectations for what you can and can't do.
And that's a really good point, and that would be a great place to do it. That makes a lot of sense, Jamie. Well, let's switch gears a little bit again. One of the things that's very different, well, it is and it isn't. I mean, we all have weather. We're all driving around in all kinds of weather and different types of environments, but I think it's probably a bigger factor in the rural area. Plus, you're dealing with things like animals and snakes and spiders and that kind of thing. What are your thoughts on that, Kyle, as far as a rural environment? How much more of an effect may it have on rural providers?
Well, Sam, I think those effects are amplified in the rural setting. You know, it's definitely something that we have to consider. And I think, as Jamie was saying earlier, we have to be transparent, not just with the community, but with ourselves as well and within our own agencies, and realize, you know, how some of these factors are going to affect us and affect the public that we serve.
Very true. Chris, what kinds of things do you think of, you know, discussing this topic as far as what you've seen in a rural environment as opposed to an urban environment?
I'm sorry, you were breaking up a little bit there, Sam. I didn't get the question.
Oh, sorry about that. What kind of things do you think environmentally, be it weather or critters or whatever else, has a more profound effect in a rural environment than it does in an urban environment?
Oh, I think it all has a significant effect. The driving conditions, number one, we encounter dirt roads, we encounter gravel roads, we encounter no road, and your traditional style, you know, type one, type two, or type three ambulance is not really equipped to respond to some of these areas. Obviously, you're dealing with, a different environment as far as animals. I had a crew that just took care of a level one trauma patient who was gored by a bull. That's not something you see in downtown Oklahoma City. It's a totally different response and a totally different mindset. And, you know, we've set up our industry for, as I said, the urban and suburban environments, but, I'm sure as, the panel can discuss in their particular regions, there's definitely challenges with snow and ice and, other situations that not all ambulances are set up to, be able to move well in. So, again, it's a redesigning of how we provide in these areas. I think that's really the key, and I agree, the public and governmental education is absolutely essential.
Well, Kyle just mentioned something offsides about flash flood warnings and that kind of thing. I can well imagine your guys getting up into a situation where something like that may happen, and there's not a lot of room to maneuver or to get away from it in terms of a mudslide or something like that. It's not like you have a cement road you can get on and get out of the area.
Absolutely. I cannot recall how long ago it was, but we had a very rainy season where we actually had situations where we had road closures for miles. So rerouting ambulances, trying to go to an acute care facility became a huge problem because there are some areas that there's only one or two paved accesses to get to these places. And, it becomes a huge, huge problem for us. I vividly remember a helicopter rescue by the Oklahoma Highway Patrol with a firefighter hanging off of his skid to pluck somebody from a car. And then those, again, are not situations we're going to take a fully loaded ambulance into to try to do that work. It's just not the right resource.
Absolutely. Jamie, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I just think you have to be prepared and know the resources you have available to you. One of our services in our county is the designated water rescue service, though two other fire departments also have boats. But one of the services is specifically designated as a swift water rescue trained service. So when we have things like a flash flooding and things like that, we start calling on the resources. We know which places around us have boats and which places around us have certain types of training. The same thing goes for high angle rescue, where you're dealing with people. We have a couple of places right here on the Chesapeake Bay where there's some cliffs that lead down into the water, and several times a summer someone walks a little too close to the edge and slips over or falls down towards the shore below and has to be airlifted out or otherwise brought out from that situation. And again, it comes down to understanding and knowing what resources you have for your service and what kinds of vehicles or other types of resources are available to deal with specific given situations when you have those technical rescues needed.
So, Kyle, as we speak, you got some flash flooding warnings going on up there, huh?
Yes, indeed. Just got the flash flood warning from our National Weather Service friends in Grand Junction, the Burn Scar area, very close to my house. We just got a flash flood warning. We've been getting rain all day, so just waiting for the tones to drop here momentarily. But while I am still with all you great folks this evening, I just wanted to add a little bit on my earlier comment. I mean, the effect of weather on responders, especially in the rural environment, it can be truly prolific. We in, you know, most agencies, if not at the county level, perhaps the regional level, may have access to a group of search and rescue folks, and they can operate in some of the more remote environments in your area. Like here, we have Mountain Rescue Aspen, as well as many other teams in the mountains, and they will put themselves in harm's way to rescue folks and to, of course, affect rescues and help save lives. In, you know, the driving rain, the blinding snow, and the blowing wind. So they operate within a certain level of acceptable risk. And that's a risk that, of course, is discussed and reviewed before they ever go into the field. That's reviewed in Colorado, the sheriff's office is in charge of managing search and rescue operations. So they weigh in on that decision as well. And ultimately, the responders on the ground, you know, whether I say on the ground, but it could be in a boat, in the air, in a all-terrain vehicle, whatever it is, just understanding and having the realization that I don't care what kind of fire truck you have, what kind of vehicle you have, what kind of boat, whatever, you and your equipment are not invincible. And we see it time and time again, responders becoming injured because they, you know, you have the hero complex sometimes, and you know, we want to get to the patient, we want to do good, but we have to understand the limits of our equipment to operate within the environment, as well as the limits of our responders to operate within the environment. So getting, you know, doing those safety assessments beforehand and sometimes realizing, hey, it may be better for us to say shelter in place or to explore other options for accessing or transporting that patient or our staff so as to not add further risk to this operation. So just always something to keep in mind. Safety is number one. And just like we always learn when we do scene size up and things like that, responder safety is number one, and we have to keep that in mind going forward.
Wise words, my friend. And if you suddenly drop off the call, I hope it's not because you're floating down the hill somewhere. So stay safe up there. Chris, another thing I was thinking about, we talked a lot about provider injuries. Well, what about the different types of injuries we may see with patients out there? Joe did a whole thing with us on agricultural injuries. Do you get a lot of that out there?
Absolutely. And I'm smiling from ear to ear right now because of something that you taught me in my basic EMT class in Cerritos College many years ago. And I still tell this story to this day. I remember vividly in our book the discussion of the power takeoff shaft injuries, and I never knew what a power takeoff shaft was until I moved to Oklahoma. So we see a lot of agricultural machinery injuries, a lot of collapse with not only obviously rural construction sites, but if you've ever had anybody trapped in a grain elevator and the cascading, you know, grain that comes down inside of those things, that's a specialty all to itself. We see a lot of large animal agricultural injuries, and we see a lot of auto versus, cattle, horses, wild boar, those types of things. So it's a little bit of a different environment as far as those types of injuries. And then again, when you're in that level one scenario where that patient really needs a trauma team and those minutes count, how far are you away from that trauma center? Can you get an aeromedical resource? Do you have to go by ground? Again, another very challenging scenario, but the rural communities offer you a plethora of very, very challenging situations. And the other side of that, from a clinician standpoint, I think you get to really hone your paramedic skills because you have an opportunity to obviously provide those interventions and therapies, and you have the elapsed time of transport to see how well you do. And that can either be a very exciting moment for your practice or a very sobering moment for your practice. And as we know, most of those paramedics are kind of migrating toward the larger systems with the better compensation. So those folks in the rural area are really earning their stripes. And I'm proud of that every day for my folks.
Absolutely. And it's so nice when your students remember those little factoids 20 years later. We won't go there. So, Jamie, I'm going to throw this to you and let you wrap it.
No, it's been a great discussion, and you know, I just second the fact that, you know, being in a rural area with lots of farms around us as well, having seen injuries ranging from catastrophic amputations to somebody who slid feet first into a grain auger, you know, it's challenging, because not only do you end up in those situations often with a patient to deal with, but you also come up with a very difficult technical rescue situation requiring some pulling together of numerous community resources to free up a patient from some of these situations. You know, I'd just like to thank Joe. I know he had to slip off the call, but, you know, a lot of this comes down to training. Chris alluded to it, you know, all the things that he is bringing back and the memories that of a class that he didn't understand came back to him when he went on later in his career. Every bit of training we do comes together at some point. And can help us if we're only prepared for it. And that means that we need to continue to get training and continue to add to what we learn. And that's why we're really happy to have Paragon Medical Education Group sponsor our program every week. Joe is a great representative of the type of resources they bring to bear, the educational materials and the customizable programs they can put in place for just about every service, including rural services. And Joe talks a lot about trying to make sure that it's affordable and they can pull together grants for different things. There are grants out there for rural medical services and rural EMS and rural hospital services. And all those things can be brought to bear to bring training into a community that might not think they can afford some of these more advanced types of training. So reach out to the Paragon Medical Education Group. You can find them over at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can reach out to them via the link on disasterpodcast.com, or you can just get onto our Facebook group and reach out to Joe there. He'd be happy to have a discussion with you there and offline about what he can do to bring some people into your system and bring you some really amazing top flight disaster and medical training. So reach out to Joe, and a thanks again to Paragon Medical Group for their sponsorship of the program. Chris, is there a place people can reach out to you? You have a wealth of information and knowledge that might help somebody that's just coming into a job like yours and needs to lean on the years of experience you have.
I have a personal Facebook page, which is Chris Prutzman. We have our Samaritan EMS Oklahoma public-facing Facebook page, and they can reach out to me at the toll-free number there, or my business email is prutz@samaritanemsok.com.
And Chris, thanks for coming on the show again. You're always welcome, and we appreciate you kind of bringing this topic together for us tonight.
Thanks for having me. I always look forward to speaking with you folks.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social media channels under the handle WX Kyle Nelson, so feel free to follow along. Most active on Twitter and Instagram, but always up for a good LinkedIn request as well.
Awesome, awesome. And Sam, how about yourself?
You'll find me in all those social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. Also on our Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast. And last time I looked, we're pushing 650 members, so that's pretty awesome. And of course on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jimmy?
Well, people can always find me on most social media channels under the handle PodMedic. So search me there and friend, follow, or otherwise connect. And always, find us over on our Facebook group. You can just look up Disaster Podcast on Facebook and request to join the group there. Or you can follow us over on our disasterpodcast.com page. While you're there, you can find different ways to subscribe using your mobile device of choice. So you just scroll down there on the side, you'll see a spot where it says subscribe to the podcast, and click the button that makes sense for what you'd like to do, and we'll be happy to be able to deliver this to you on a regular basis whenever new episodes come out. Sam, you know, we've talked about a lot of things in this episode, but it seems like it's just important to remember that, you know, rural EMS is a kind of a different animal in many cases.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of pearls of wisdom in this episode. It might be worth listening to a couple times to capture them all. But I guess we could say that rural medicine is not our everyday medicine.